Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the eighth session of our class and the final session of our class. Today's topics will be devoted to genetics and stored tissue, and then we'll end with another case discussion and then some evaluations and post-tests and things like that. So to get us started this morning, we're going to talk about ethical issues in genetic research, and we are lucky to have with us Dr. Ben Wilfond, who used to work here with us in the Department of Bioethics and in NHGRI, but a few years ago moved out to Seattle, and he is now the Truman Katz director of the Truman Katz Center for Pediatric Bioethics at Seattle Children's Hospital, and a professor and head of the Division of Bioethics in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. So we're really thrilled to have him with us today. Ben.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And there we go. So my talk will be divided up into three general sections. I'll sort of make a few comments about genetics and genetic research in general, then spend about 15 minutes with an overview of broadly the issues related to genetic research, and the rest of the talk will be focusing on three specific issues in more detail. When we think about genetic research, there's a really wide range of studies that might count as genetic research. Sometimes we're talking about studies that are describing a particular phenotype of a condition or the relationship between that phenotype and a genotype. Other studies are looking at the ways in which either the physical or the social environment interact with genetics to create the phenotype. Another type of genetic research are that type of research that really looks not so much at the genetics, but at people's response to genetic information. So I include that in the context of genetic research only because when I worked with Sarah Hall, who you'll be hearing from next, with the NHGRI IRB, much of our research was not only about the genes, but about what people did with the information. And finally, the last type of project that might count as genetic research are interventional studies, which might either be behavioral interventions because of the information, pharmacological interventions based on the information, or even gene transfer research. So genetic research is an incredibly broad topic. We could have a whole day talking about that. Today, what I'll be focusing my talk on are these first two topics of natural history studies and what I call environmental studies, which are the more classical type of genetic studies. Another thing that distinguishes or complicates thinking about genetic research is the fact that we have to be clear about what recruitment approach we're taking. Are we talking about a population study or a family-based study? Are we talking about the prospective collection of information, or are we talking about the retrospective evaluation of information? That second topic, again, Dr. Hull will be covering in more detail later. And finally, the laboratory approach. Are we talking about DNA-based gene expression, what type of strategy are we talking about? Those will have some implications for what the issues are. The last sort of general point I'll make is that there's an overlap between this issue of genetics broadly, the issues related to the storage and future use of samples, and the psychosocial implications of information. And these are overlapping, but they're distinct. And so it's important to be clear about which of these we're thinking about when we have questions about genetic research. And I think in a very general sense, what really drives many of the questions about how we should ethically do genetic research, it really has to do with thinking about how we respond or how we are concerned about the potential psychosocial implications of the information. There's a number of characteristics of genetic information that are not unique to genetics but are important. These features are also true for a variety of other circumstances as well, whether it's related to infectious disease or other non-genetic conditions. First, the information itself can be very complex and often uncertain. That creates challenges for the communication. Sometimes this information has special cultural meaning for particular groups. There are familial implications of the information. It's not just about the person, but about other people. Has impact on reproduction. And the risks unlike other types of research, are primarily psychosocial rather than physical, which on one hand is really good. In general, people don't die being involved in genetic research studies. So we have, that actually makes it much less risky than many of the types of research that we see going on. But the psychosocial impact, which are subtle and maybe more wide-reaching, can also be very challenging. It also makes it challenging because it's because it is not as tangible sometimes. It can be either overestimated or underestimated as well. So what I could do now is share with you a case that illustrates some of the issues that can come up in genetic research. And it's also a way of illustrating some of the complexities that happen not so much at the level of designing a protocol, but in trying to actually carry out the study. This was actually a case that actually occurred here with colleagues at the NCI, and that happened a number of years ago, but it was a very interesting project or an interesting issue. There were several families several generations of a family that were enrolled in a study that would provide them with BRCA1 results. And the researchers promised that each person's test results would be confidential. Now, as many of you know, BRCA1 is an autosomal dominant gene that accounts for roughly 5% of all breast cancer. People who have BRCA mutations have a 50 to 85% chance of developing breast cancer at some point, and there is a possibility of reducing their risk either through surveillance or through surgical or chemo-preventive interventions. So this is the family that we'll be talking about. You can see the 57-year-old man who has a sister with breast cancer, has a father who had both breast cancer and prostate cancer, and a grandmother who had ovarian cancer. He has three children, 23, 17, and 12. And so before he has testing, he says that he wants to protect his father from feelings of transmission guilt. So he doesn't want to tell his father what his result will be. He gets his result. He is a BRCA carrier. He tells the researchers that he'll let his daughter know that he is a carrier when the time is right. We later on hear from his niece that he has told his father that he's negative. And so the research team is worried that he will not disclose to his daughter that she is at risk and that she should consider BRCA testing and that she'll assume that she's negative and will just forgo this. So the question we have to think about is how the researcher should balance their obligations to protect the confidentiality of the father with a duty to inform the daughter to avoid the harm. Now, it's not clear whether or not there has or hasn't been a disclosure. All we hear from the niece is what he's told the father. And the general recommendation for the timing of beginning surveillance or other interventions is roughly around the age of 25. So we do have a couple of years to sort of sort this out, given that the oldest daughter is 23. Now, when we think about whether there's an obligation to disclose the father's results to the daughter, I think one thing that makes this case particularly interesting is the fact that the father just didn't keep information confidential, but he actively misled his daughter. He actually gave her false information that had an impact on her health. And the question we can think about is whether or not that itself has a particular impact on what our decision will be. Now, what I'm going to really, I want to use this case just as an example. So rather than spending a lot of time discussing how to approach this case, I want just to use that to sort of illustrate the issues that come up. When we think about the duty to disclose, the criteria we should think about are ones that have really been discussed for the last 20 or 30 years practically, well, 25 years, that include how serious is the harm of non-disclosure, how likely is it harm, how avoidable is it, and whether or not there are or not other reasonable alternatives. And I think in this case, the final decision that the research team made was to continue having conversations with the father, realizing that there was time and hoping over time that he would be able to get to a place where he would be willing to share this information with his daughter. So what this case does illustrate is that when we think about the potential harms of genetic information or the concerns or risks, they're really related to the sharing of information. And when we think about this sharing of information, there are three broad ways to think about it. In some cases, we're planning on sharing the information. So in the example of this BRCA1 case, there was plans to actually provide this information back to the individuals. Sometimes there might be unintended sharing, breaches of confidentiality, where it was shared, but that's not what we were wanting to happen. And there's other circumstances where there are no plans to share information, and so I'll spend some time talking about some of the issues that still arise even in that situation. Now, because of time, I won't be discussing all of the potential types of risks and issues related to disclosure of information. I've highlighted three: familial implications, community harms, and what I describe as harmless wrongdoings, that I'll spend a little bit more time talking about. The other ones on here are fairly, I wouldn't say routine, but ones that people are often familiar with: the concern about the complexity of the information, for that to cause confusion or to cause anxiety, concerns about stigmatization, concerns about discrimination. These are questions that arise with genetic information. It's true for all information, in fact. But I want to really focus on this issue of familial implications and these others. And the familial implications are interesting because sometimes there are things that we may not think about right away. We often do think about issues of adoption, paternity, the fact that when we do genetic testing, we may find out unexpected family relationships. One of the other issues that comes up is, what about testing adult children? That is, adults whose parents also are at risk for a particular condition, where providing the information to the adult child is also giving them information about their father or their mother that their father and mother may not themselves want to know, either themselves or want the children to know. But because they're in a family where there is a risk, they may learn this information. So that's one of the issues that comes up sometimes. Another issue that relates to that is the issue of twins. If you have two different twins who have different preferences for what information they're interested in learning, and they're identical twins, there could be the challenge of, by testing one, you are potentially learning information about the other that they may or may not want to know. Another issue that comes up, particularly in the research context, with families, if you're doing family-based studies, is the issue of trying to figure out how to recruit families and engaging the family members as part of your recruitment strategy, and whether it's better to have the family recruit them or whether it's better to have the investigator recruit them. And people have looked at this and argued both in both directions, that there are advantages of each approach in terms of which approach is more likely to be more effective in recruitment, but also which approach is more likely to for the family members to feel less sort of pressure to participate. And I think this is, in my view, a fairly unsettled area, and I think more than one approach is probably reasonable. The second issue I wanted to talk in a little bit more detail, because this comes up a lot, is the question of community harms. In other words, even if information is not being provided directly to participants, might there be some adverse effects on communities, whether it might reinforce cultural stereotypes about a particular community, or whether the community might feel exploited by being involved in the genetic research project. These are the two sort of general claims that are sometimes made. It raises some additional questions about what counts as a community, who speaks for that community, and what role these communities should have. These three questions are, again, not unique to genetics. These are actually the challenges we face in a wide range of ethical issues that involve communities. And I just want to point this out as one of the things that we do face as we think about this. The last general point I'll make has to do with this notion of harmless wrongdoing. And the idea of harmless wrongdoing is borrowed from the title of a book by Joel Feinberg about almost 20 years ago, that talks about the ways in which people may be wronged even if they're not harmed. And so the concern here would be, even if there's no adverse consequences, no confusion, no stigmatization, no discrimination, but still people feel that they've been wronged by the research that's been done. And so essentially this accounts to concerns that may occur about being involved in a research study in which you have not given permission for being involved in it. Now, there may be several reasons why people might be concerned about this. One is curiosity. They might have just wanted to know that they were involved in the study. So, again, here I'm talking about, just to be clear, I'm talking about examples where the person might have given a sample for clinical purposes, and that sample is then being used for research purposes. So they might be, even if their name was unlinked from the sample, people might have concerns about this. One of them is just curiosity. They might just say, hey, I would have liked to have known that they're doing the study because I'd be curious to know what the answer was. One concern might be privacy. They might say, I really would not want anyone else to know that piece of information, and this is my information, and I want to sort of keep this to myself. Some might object to the research objectives. It may be that the purpose of the research is one that they feel in particular that they are have they're opposed to for one reason or another. So, for example, a study of homosexuality, somebody might say, you know, I'm not interested in contributing my DNA for a study of this. Or some might object to a study in which somebody will make a profit from. So these are just examples of reasons why some people have said that even in circumstances where information is not linked to a particular person, that some people would still want to be able to give permission for participating in the project. Now, in spite of these concerns, there are a number of reasons for not getting consent when you have unlinked samples. First, maybe impractical. People may have moved away. It may be hard to find people. It may be upsetting to contact a person 5, 10, 15 years later. Imagine you get a call out of the blue saying, you know, we have a sample from you from, you know, 20 years ago. Do you mind if we do X, Y, and Z on it? That might just be a nuisance or irritating. It takes a lot of effort. Another reason why people are concerned about this, it's a lot of work to try to contact people when you have, say, 1,000 samples sitting in a laboratory. Even if you could reach everybody, it might take a lot of additional resources to do that. And the final reason that some people is that people might not give consent. Now, this is obviously, at least in my view, not a good, probably the one reason that's the least compelling, because certainly if your concern is that they would say no, that would probably be the most important reason to actually ask them. Now, I think in general, and Sarah will be talking about this in much more detail, we have to really the challenge is to balance the concerns that people might have about participation without consent with the value of the research. So what I've done so far is try to give you some examples of the types of concerns that people raise about genetic research. But I think it's important to obviously point out that the reason why we do the research is because this has tremendous benefits for subjects as well as for society. So clearly, the challenge we have to figure out is how do we allow this research to go forward, as we have for many years, and to balance that with the potential risks of harm either to subjects or society. And the way we do that is by developing a protections based upon how we design the study, what sort of oversight we have of the study, and informed consent. And so the protections that we have, more specifically, the way I view them is that they're really designed to minimize risks. And there's two broad protections, I think, that we use in genetic research. One are trying to reduce the psychosocial impact related to the disclosure of the information, and the second is trying to protect the confidentiality of the information. And the ways that we can either reduce the impact related to the disclosure is either making decisions whether or when to disclose information, and if we do disclose it, make sure we're providing adequate explanations for it. Clearly, oversight can be important, and related to this issue of community harms, having community engagement and protocol development can be one of the ways of approaching that. And then, of course, informed consent is the other protection. And what I'm going to do now for the rest of my comments is really focus on the issues related to the disclosure results and informed consent. So this is just a slide for me to put in there to break up the talk to the next section, which is talking about the disclosure results. So the question we have to decide as examples are, when do we decide which individual results to disclose to participants? And so you can imagine there's a range of different types of results we might be considering. We may be talking about information that we may be using in a treatment trial to make some decisions about which treatment we use or how we use it. We also may be talking about something like APOE4, which has a predictive risk of Alzheimer's disease, but again, it's being used in a study to try to prevent, to see whether it will have an impact on preventing Alzheimer's disease. So again, these are two examples where the information might have some relevance explicitly to the person who's enrolled in the trial. in contrast to these two other examples in which are not small studies but are much larger population-based epidemiological studies where the researchers may have much less contact with the individual person. And one example I give here of BRCA1 is meant to suggest that in some cases the information we're talking about is information that is very well known, very well, relatively well characterized, that has particular implications, as I described earlier in the talk. But in other cases, we may be talking about results that are of completely undetermined significance in a longitudinal study. And what are our obligations to provide that information? Now, a number of years ago, actually, while I was here at the NIH, I worked with one of our fellows, Varjit Ravitsky, on this question. And what I want to do is spend about 5 minutes talking with you about how we approached this question and to give you a framework for thinking about that. And as we looked into this issue, we realized that there were two prevailing approaches that were somewhat in tension with each other. One that we described as a research-focused approach in contrast to an autonomy-focused approach. And the approach that we suggested was a hybrid of these two that we describe as result-focused. So the research-focused approach has a rationale that the goal of research is primarily to provide generalizable knowledge to benefit society. And the approach based upon this rationale is that generally results should not be provided unless the information has extraordinary clinical value. If it's really meaningful, then of course you should provide it, but the default should be not to provide the information because that's not why you're doing the research. You're doing the research to provide information for society. However, one of the objections to this approach is that researchers do have obligations and responsibilities to participants, and it may be the case that there is a greater obligation to provide information to the people than simply just to improve social value of the research. The autonomy-focused approach really begins with the objection to the research-focused approach and suggests that individuals should have access and control of all the information about them. And this rationale drives an approach that says that results generally should be offered unless there's very clear evidence that the information will be harmful. And in fact, even though I described to you a range of possible harms of genetic information, those are possible harms. There's a lot less data about whether people themselves are actually harmed or the proportion they're actually harmed. And so while people may be harmed, it's hard to predict on an individual basis that a particular person would be harmed. Now, I think the objection to this approach is that this is conflating research with clinical care. Presumably this is an issue you've had previous discussions about, that there are different approaches to research and clinical care, and often we get the trouble when we just think of research as an extension of clinical care. Second issue, it's not really clear what data counts as information. Are we talking about giving somebody the series of traces from their DNA, or are we actually asking them for specific interpretations of the information. So the approach that Varjit and I settled on was one that we describe as a research-focused approach, in which we distinguish between informational considerations and relational considerations. And what we liked about this approach is it really was a way of taking a range of values into account rather than focusing on one or the other in a very explicit way. So we can think about obligations of beneficence, which might include obligations to offer results when they're likely to be helpful, as well as obligations to not offer them when they're likely to be harmful. There's issues of respect, obligations to respect preferences, but either to receive or not receive information, as well as issues of reciprocity, which perhaps do form a justification for why, all things being equal, it may be good to provide information based upon the contribution of the research of the subject. But that has to be balanced with obligations to be good stewards of our resources for research and deciding when is it appropriate to how much of those resources should be put in to providing results, providing the explanation for results, versus using those same resources for doing further research. And you can imagine a continuum of this, and, you know, if it was, you know, it's probably not 99-1 in either direction. It's something somewhere in between. But that's really a question of how much resources are appropriate. And you can always imagine that there'll be somebody who will want you to do more than you might want to do. So the purpose of this result-focused approach was to try to give both investigators and IRBs a way of thinking about this as they design a study. And the way we approach this is to suggest that there's really three options you have. Either make a decision to offer results. Second is to make a decision to refer to other places where people can get those same results, or not to offer the results. And I want to be clear that we're talking about not offering individual results. And in fact, even in those circumstances, it probably makes sense to inform people about the aggregate results of the entire study. The value of this approach is that it suggests that there's not one single answer to a particular problem, and that there might be some reason for IRBs and investigators to have some discretion about the best way to do this. And the purpose of our approach is really to give people a framework to help them make the decision that made the most sense to them. Now, the informational considerations we're referring to regard the quality of information we get from the study. Analytic validity refers to the accuracy of the actual assay that we're doing. Clinical utility refers to how the individual person will use the information. And so, in other words, can they use the information to improve their health? And those two things we felt were perhaps the most important considerations in making a decision about whether or not to provide the information. There's two additional pieces of information. One is the personal meaning of the information to the individual, as well as the clinical validity. Now, clinical validity refers to the ability of the information to predict that a person may or may not have the condition we're talking about. And the reason why I put that below personal meaning is that while we often assume that clinical validity is necessary for it to have personal meaning, in fact, people may attribute personal meaning even though we ourselves may be somewhat skeptical of the validity of the information. But the point of dividing up these categories into an upper and a lower is because, in fact, I think the first two are the ones that really drive the questions, and the second two are really modifiers of how we might want to think about this. And I'll come back to that in a few moments. The second set of considerations besides informational considerations are what I describe as relational considerations, which have to do with the nature of the relationship between the investigator and the participants. Is this a longitudinal study where they have ongoing contact, or was this a one-time visit with the investigator, or do they have no direct contact with that person at all? Second is the capacities of the investigators to offer the results safely and effectively. Do they have the personnel to educate the individuals about this, or is this a person who's doing research who is a PhD in biochemistry in an undergraduate college who's doing a project and has not had an interaction with a patient in 20 years? That person may not be in a position to safely offer those results. And whether or not there is alternative access to the same information for participants by other resources. Now, when clinical utility is established, in other words, when the information is clearly useful, these relational considerations can help guide the specific approach or the best way to give the information. In circumstances where clinical utility has not been established, it's not clear how helpful this will be to people, then depending upon the personal meaning and the clinical validity, these other informational considerations, the relationships can also then guide that information. I just want to give you a couple quick examples of this. So in a circumstance where the analytic validity and the clinical utility are both established, it's pretty clear, it seems like that's the easy case where it makes sense to offer the information to people because we have a reliable test, we know it's going to be helpful, and that makes it fairly straightforward. I think where things break down are circumstances where these are not as well established. And what I want to do to some extent is focus on the yellow box where there is personal meaning, but not analytic validity or clinical utility, and there it may be contingent upon the relationships. Now, actually, I think I have these slides in the reversed order, so let me just switch. I'll go back then. So in circumstances where there is personal meaning, but clinical utility has not been established, then we need to think about these questions about these investigative capacities, alternative access, and relationships with participants. And the point here is that whether or not to offer the information when there is personal meaning depends upon whether there's a relationship with the individuals and whether the people have the capacity to do that. And if without those things being those circumstances being met, it may not make sense to offer results. But in circumstances where the investigators do have the capacity, where there is no available access to the information, and there's a developed relationship, then it makes sense to offer the information. Actually, I'll just, because of time, I think I'll just skip over this last slide anyway. So the last set of comments I'd like to make really have to do with some questions about informed consent. And you'll be hearing a little bit more about this from Sarah. In fact, actually, this current slide that I'm showing you now is a slide that Sarah also will have in her talk, but because it's really one of the central questions that we all think about with genetic research, which is what information do you need to provide on the consent form and to give to subjects when you're thinking about involving them in a genetic research study. And there is really a continuum of information that we could think about providing for people about this. One is to really suggest to them that we're asking them to participate in any genetic research study. We're saying, would you like to be in a genetic research study? The other alternative is to be much more specific and say exactly which disease you're talking about, which particular gene you're studying, the exact methodology of how you're going to study that gene, who the actual investigators will be doing the research, and the time frame in which the research will be done. Now, and obviously there is a range between these two. And so there's been a lot of debate about what should, when people ask for permission to participate in research, how specific does that permission need to be? Does it need to be very specific, or can it be very general? Now, to think about this question, it's actually, there's two related questions. One have to do with the consent form itself, perhaps, and the other has to do with how you approach the options for this. Now, typically, this is often described as blanket consent or specific consent, but the term that I prefer to use is a la carte or prefix, because I think it suggests, because the blanket consent is usually seen as a much more negative way. I think, and there are many different ways this can be done. The challenge here is that you can imagine one approach on this side here would be say, look, in a standard consent form, describe generally what you're planning on doing. Now, that description could still be very specific or it could be very broad, but it's just a description in that particular consent form. The other thing that comes up is the issue of having a separate consent form for the genetic portion of the study. I've seen this a number of times where there'll be one consent form for everything but the genetic aspects and then a separate consent form for the genetic parts. Personally, I find that a bit confusing. I'll give you some slides that sort of suggest why I think that is, but that often is one of the ways it's done. The other question that comes up is whether or not people should have a description made of what will happen, or whether they should be given choices about what they'd like to be happen. So, for example, should the information be shared with other investigators or not? In some cases, we might actually say in the consent form, it will or won't be shared. In other cases, the question may be, do you want it to be shared? Do you want us to do research on X, Y, and Z disease? And so these are the sort of things that are floating around. There are a wide range of ways that this can be done. I just picked up the pointer rather than the slide mover. So the reasons for this a la carte approach or the specific approach is that it's a way of respecting people's preferences. It can hopefully facilitate understanding by asking them to make these specific choices. Therefore, that will increase enrollment. And also, and the other reason for doing it is that often I think that when investigators write this, it clarifies the study design. It clarifies what they're planning on doing with the information. Now, those reasons for the other approach are actually often the counter of the reasons for the blanket approach, for the a la carte approach. And this suggests that, in fact, people really don't have that much strong preferences. Frankly, people may not really care that much about which disease you're studying, who the investigator is, what the time frame is. These are sort of below the radar and below the interest of most people. In fact, actually, what the research has shown is that there's a range of views about this. Some people do care. Many people don't care. And it really goes along the whole way. Another reason for thinking about the prefix consent approach is that genetic research is a specific research approach. If by saying we're doing genetic research, we have narrowed this down from the whole wide range of all the things we could be doing with somebody in a research context. So this is really quite specific. The other concern is that when we give these options, do you want us to do X, Y, and Z, or what about this, that itself may be confusing, and it may not always be clear what is being meant when those questions are being asked. So there's a real debate about whether or not that's clarifying or confusing. And we may want to prioritize this type of information we're offering to people with other information that they may need to make a decision of being in the study. Finally, people may not fully appreciate the significance when they make a decision, so just because they checked off a particular box doesn't mean that was a real considered deliberation. So they may say, no, please don't share this with anybody, where in fact that's not what they really meant, or vice versa. So these comments are really ways of giving me a chance to make a few suggestions about consent forms. You've heard a lot about consent, I'm sure, over the course of this course. I think what's important is to clarify the purpose of the consent form as a decision-making tool. Rather than thinking of the consent form as a place to clarify the study design, to specify what exactly will happen in the study, that should be done in the protocol. And that really we should tailor the information to the particulars of the study, what we think we want to do. If we think we want to share the information, we should say that. And we also should really prioritize what information is necessary to improve decision making. And there may be a lot of information that we may be able to include either in supplemental materials, or as I mentioned before, this is information that really doesn't belong in the protocol, but belongs doesn't belong in the consent form, but belongs in the protocol. One of my favorite examples of that is information about confidentiality. It's probably very important in the protocol to describe in exquisite detail all the ways in which you'll be protecting confidentiality. You may want to talk about your encryption system for your passwords, who will have access to the information, how it's going to be coded. And the question is, if you put all that in the consent form, is that actually interpretable by anybody? And is it better just to say, we will do our best to keep it confidential? And the details probably need to be in the protocol rather than the consent form. And, well, the slide says the same thing, so I think I can just skip over this. So let me end. I've got about 7 minutes, then we'll have time for a discussion with one final question. Because I'm a pediatrician, one of the questions that I've been interested in for a long time is thinking about how do we think about doing genetic research with children and what's the scope of parental permission? And Sarah and I, when we were here, did a project where we actually did a survey of people about their attitudes about this question. And the three questions we asked people, whether it's acceptable to begin research with the first question we want to think about was this, about whether or not we should be able to begin research without the consent of the child and just the permission of the parent. The second is it necessary to obtain the consent of the child once old enough to continue doing research on the samples? The third question is whether or not we should obtain consent if we can't contain consent. If we can't obtain consent, should the samples be destroyed? So before I show you the results of our study, let's take a poll room for each of these three questions. So the first one, is it acceptable to begin research with on children without their consent, just the permission? Who would say yes to that? Raise your hand. Okay. And who would say no? A few people. Okay. How about, is it necessary to obtain consent from the child once old enough to continue research? How many would say yes to that? Okay. How many would say no? Okay? And then what if we can't, and if we're not able to obtain consent, should the samples be destroyed? How many would say yes, destroy the samples? Okay? And how many would say no? A little more variety of that one. Okay. So the way we approached this question was to provide this little vignette to about 1,200 people in a survey that we did, and we asked them to sort of imagine that they had been in the situation when they were children that their parents had done this for them. And this information has been there, that the samples have been there for many years, and now they're adults, and now the people want to continue doing the research on their sample. So So in this case, of the folks that we asked this question to, roughly slightly more than half did not think their consent should be required in order to continue using the samples. Half just said no. But roughly half said yes. Of the half who said yes, we asked how many would be willing to give consent. And as you can see, almost everybody said yes. They would be willing to give consent if they were asked. Of that group that we asked, who said they're willing to give consent, we said, okay, so you're willing to give consent, but what if we couldn't find you? What do you think in that circumstance? And this was interesting because half said yes and half said no. So in essence, we had roughly 26% of the individuals in our sample would be concerned that if people continued to do research on their samples as they became adults, even if they couldn't be located. So what I could do is to spend a few minutes on each of these topics. And the first is this question about whether it's acceptable to begin research with just parental permission. You know, and I think here the issue, I think for me the answer is yes. I think it is because we have a presumption of parental authority for decision-making about children. And so we, in fact, involve children in research all the time with their parents' permission. And I think in that regard, I don't think genetic research is really any different from any other research that we allow parents to enroll their children in. The IRB looks carefully at the risks and benefits. We limit parental decision-making. We think the risks are too great. Specifically, we make sure that the study itself should not have a minor increase over minimal risk. And so as long as the study that we're looking at doesn't pose those risks, that's certainly consistent with the approach we've taken for most pediatric research. And the reason for all this is because we actually believe that there's a lot of value of conducting research on children. In fact, if anything, the concerns in the past have been we've done too little research on children. We do things to kids without research. As a pediatrician, it's very challenging because many of the drugs that we use, we don't have information about how well they work. So doing research on children is something that is certainly a generally widespread practice without their permission. The question is, what happens when they become adults? And so is it necessary to get consent for continued use? Now, if we had a chance to have a discussion about this more generally, I think one of the issues that people would identify is, well, what do we mean by consent? Are we talking about agreeing to continued use based upon signing a form? Are we talking just more generally about the agreement to use the information? Or are we talking about respecting the preferences of those who request no future use? So I think depending on what we mean by consent may give us a slightly different answer to the question. In my view, the key thing here is respecting the preferences of people who would not want continued use. So therefore, the issue is trying to figure out how we can have adequate disclosure, whether it's through direct conversations or newsletters. And I think that's really the critical issue, is figuring out a way of giving them the information. Then if they say they don't want it, that's great, and then we shouldn't do it. But I think that's different from requiring an unambiguous affirmative consent before going ahead and doing the research. So in other words, if I had a chance to ask somebody, can we do this, and they say yes, that's great. If they say no, I'd respect that. But there may be some circumstances where we can't ask them. And that really gets us to the third question, about when is it appropriate to proceed when we can't ask. I'll back up. I kind of lost track of my thoughts. The point I was trying to make here is that there are examples where we do proceed unless people say no. So there's a lot of things that we often will do in life that we just do, and only if people say no do we stop. We may choose to park our car in front of our neighbor's house, but if they tell us not to, we certainly won't in the future. But we may be willing to do that ahead of time. Often nowadays, we have people enrolling in retirement programs without their consent, but we respect their decision to say no to that. We have a telemarketing do not call list within research. Emergency research is often done sometimes without consent, but we still respect people's preferences when they can express them. And the way we make these decisions really has to do with the person who is acting, who is doing something, and who the person who's objecting to it, and the value of that information or the value of that activity to both of them. So the last question is this question about whether or not we can continue to use the data from those who cannot be contacted. 25% of the people in our survey expressed some concern about this approach. And so the question we have to think about is what role should this viewpoint play in thinking about how we develop our policies? And so I think, you know, that when we try to think about how to balance these objections with the value of the research, I think it's important to point out that there may be harms to participants and to other children whether or not the research continues. So in other words, it's not simply balancing what the researcher wants and what the participants want, but in fact that there is both a social interest in doing further research and there's also a social interest in respecting individuals' rights to express their objections and to respect those. I think it's important to understand the rationale for the objections. One thing we didn't do in our study is do a good job of understanding why people were concerned about this. It may be that it's really that people value the importance of participating in decisions rather than what the decision is. That's suggested by the fact that even though many people wanted to have consent asked of them, they were quite willing to give consent. I think the other way to deal with this issue is brought through the process of community engagement. The way we deal with the fact that some people appear to be concerned about the ongoing use of samples after they become adults without their permission is to have further conversations with groups in the public about this question. My hunch would be, as that conversation goes on, that many people, as long as the research itself has important social value, would have less trouble with the idea of that research going on. I'm not suggesting that we do this for every single study, but that I believe this sort of conversation about the continued use of pediatric samples is very important. We have data that was collected 50 years ago from children. The ability to continue to analyze that data, to learn more about pediatric illness, is still valuable. And as long as we have that conversation, I think most people will be quite comfortable with that approach. So let me end by saying I don't think there's one single approach to the ethical issues in genetic research. I think it's important not to generalize, not to either over or underestimate the risks of the research, and that we should tailor our approach to how we decide about returning results and how we approach the informed consent process. And with that, I'll end, and I've got some time for questions. Okay. No questions?
That's a break.
Oh. Yeah.
Can you comment on the passage of Juvenile?
Sure. The question was, can I comment on the passage of Gina? Actually, I have a short essay coming out next month in the Hastings Center report on this question. GINA is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which was an act that attempts to protect people from discrimination based upon their genetic information. And this has been heralded as a breakthrough in genetic research because of the fact that often when studies had been done that asked people why they didn't participate in genetic research, often the issue they would bring up was that they were concerned about discrimination based upon the information. I think it'll be interesting to see what actually happens, because I'm actually skeptical that that expressed concern is actually necessarily the underlying concern about why people don't want to participate. It's a very socially acceptable reason to say why I don't want to participate. It may be a real concern, but I think for many it may be just the concern that they express. My other comment about Gina is for those people who actually are concerned, we don't really know how helpful it's really going to be. And so it's not clear that the passage of that act by itself will actually protect people. We don't know that yet. So for those people who really are seriously concerned, I wouldn't base my decision simply based upon knowing that it's passed. It's going to take another 12 months for the regulations from the rules to be established. We'll have to wait until there are actually challenges to it before we really know how powerful it is. So I think that it's completely open question.
Hi, this is a question you raised. It's not specific to your talk. It has to do with the informed consent document and how much information do I really want. We have a little code word that we often use called mitten, which is more information than I needed, because we are overwhelmed with information sometimes on the one hand, and on the other, we want to have access to it instantly when there's a question that's really important to us that may not be important to anybody else.
Right.
For example, the investigator. We may really want to know about that person and what they're going to do, and we may not care. And we live in an age when we really don't have to be limited by a single piece of paper, which is getting more and more difficult to construct. In fact, that's the point at which we're really suffering the most, I think, with these informed consent documents. What is really informing people? But why do we have to be stuck with a piece of paper anymore? When I go online, I get hot links all over the place, and if I want to look it up, I can. And the informed consent situation doesn't have to be limited to what's on the paper. Do you have any thoughts about how to inform people more individually, depending on their needs?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. I'll make two quick comments about it. One is I actually did mention in one of my quick slides that maybe went through too quickly, I did mention something about that we can figure out what information to put on the form versus supplemental information, which I was referring to other ways of doing it. And I think you're absolutely right. Having additional information for those who want is available. And so I think that each consent form shouldn't be more than a couple pages long. And there should be a real high overview of here are the basic things. A lot of the stuff we put in consent form is what will happen to you every single day. And that's really important information probably to know if you're actually in the study and you need to know what to do that particular day. Those are the instructions you have to follow. And you may want to have some idea how many hours you'll have to be there, but those details aren't necessary to make your decision. You may want them. So that's a perfect example of the sort of information that can be in whether it's in a supplemental brochure or online or various places. The other comment I'll make is that I've been involved with the National Children's Study, and for a while there was an interest and that unfortunately waned and hopefully will be resurrected, but Mary Solomon from Harvard developed a interactive web-based video for the informed consent for the National Children's Study, and for some unclear reasons that kind of was sort of developed. It was invested and developed, and that got shelved. And so the National Children's Study, what's that? It's been resurrected? That's good to, okay. That's not what I heard most recently, but you may know more than I do. This was a wonderful interactive video that really tried to give people an overview of information, allow them to get more information. It also gave people an opportunity to assess what they actually understood about the study as we're going forward. So not only can these new technologies be useful in tailoring information, we can also tailor people's comprehension or assess their comprehension, make sure they actually understand what they're doing. So I think it's a great question.
Yuan, in your talk, you talk a lot about the risks in terms of informed consent as well as the information you get and disclosure. But I was wondering why you didn't talk more about, as the question before about Gina, the risk of, the risk to your insurance, the risk to your employment, and that. Do you think these risks are basically minimal and overstated in the current literature?
Oh, well, thank you. One reason I didn't talk about them is just because there's too much to cover. And I think they are overstated to a large extent. I think that, in fact, with or without Gina, I don't see that as being the critical issue that we face in genetics. I think it's often stated, and I think it often is given too much weight and too much mileage, which even explains why Gina was such a big deal, was made out of Gina. I think the harder questions are is this information about how that information affects a person and affects a family. I think that it's really unclear how it affects people in other contexts, and while clearly those contexts would have implications, I think often more is made of that than really meets the eye.
Okay. To continue our discussion of issues related to genetics, we're going to now switch to ethical issues in the use of stored tissues in research. And to address that is Sarah Chandris Hall, who is here in the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center, but also works for the National Human Genome Research Institute. Sarah.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today, and particularly a pleasure to be able to tag team with Ben, who was responsible, actually, for bringing me here to the NIH about 10 years ago, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about these issues together. He's also done a very nice job highlighting, outlining some issues that form a helpful backdrop to the comments I'm going to make today. So with that, let me start by clarifying what exactly it is I am going to talk about with you today. So stored tissue, there's a lot of terminology, a lot of different terms used to describe these things, samples, tissues, specimens, human biological materials are some of the more common terms you might hear. For those of you out there who are sticklers for semantic precision, let me apologize because I tend to use these terms interchangeably, even though some people have very specific, subtle meanings that they assign to each of them. I think I tend to default to samples. I think human biological materials is probably the most inclusive, but it's also, it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. Generally, what I'm talking about is anything that comes from a human that's smaller than a human being that contains something useful to scientists like DNA, like antibody information that can be linked back to a living human being. So we might be talking about organs, but probably not the brain, but it could be organ or biopsies related to transplants. A very broad range of things could be included in this category. I also want to clarify, my arrows got messed up. These were supposed to be bidirectional arrows, that when I'm talking about samples, it's almost impossible to separate that out from the information that's often associated with those samples, genotypic and phenotypic data. So most of my comments today will pertain to any of these categories. So this entire issue of research with samples, with human biological materials or stored samples, is a moving target exercise. The landscape is constantly changing. I spent a lot of time this year updating my slides, even just compared to last year, because of new scientific developments, new policies, even new legislation. Gina was just mentioned. And at the same time, this issue and research using stored tissues has been something that's been going on for many decades. You'll see in a moment, one of my cases, I refer to samples that were collected as early as the 1940s. What brought this issue to the attention of ethicists and policymakers, I think, was when in the early 1990s, researchers at the CDC who were working on the NHANES study, the National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Survey, when they started to realize that this is a large population-based survey, longitudinal study that followed people and also collected samples from them over time. And the researchers realized that technology had gotten to a point where it would be really interesting and scientifically useful to start doing molecular analysis, genetic analyses of these samples. And to their credit, they went back to the consent forms that were used to collect those samples to see if they even came close to encompassing these kind of analyses. These initial questions led to the formation of a working group between folks at the CDC and with the ELSI program, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications branch. And those discussions culminated in a seminal paper, 1995 JAMA article by Ellen Clayton and others that was included in your reading packet today. And that's what really started the national and even international conversation, I think, about these questions. So where exactly are stored samples? The answer to that question is really everywhere. There are hundreds of millions of samples stored in the U.S. alone, and the numbers continue to increase. They might be held in freezers in individual laboratories, multiplied when you consider studies, the context of clinical trials, multiple investigators who are collecting samples at different sites. They're routinely stored in hospital pathology departments related to clinical diagnostic testing and other things that go on in the context of clinical care. State-run newborn screening programs collect so-called Guthrie cards, blood spots, at the time of birth to do testing for newborns, and oftentimes states will store these Guthrie cards sometimes indefinitely for epidemiological surveillance and other research purposes. The term biobanks generally refers to the deliberate creation of very large-scale repositories of samples and often associated data, and I'm going to spend some amount of time talking about biobanks in this presentation. The military also collects and stores DNA primarily for the purposes of the identification of bodies in war casualties. And then there are also significant forensic collections of DNA specimens for law enforcement purposes. So where exactly is the human subject in research with stored samples? I love this picture. It's a photograph of a pathology specimen archive that an investigator here at the NIH gave me a few years back. And we usually think of research as involving an interaction with a living, breathing individual. And in fact, that's the first definition of a human subject in the common rule when we collect data through intervention or interaction with the individual. Now, when we look a little closer at those samples, we can see a series of code numbers. They appear to be unique. And to the extent that these code numbers can be linked with information that can identify living individuals, that's another way of arriving at human subjects research. The second definition of a human subject is obtaining identifiable private information from individuals. So there are a number of activities that researchers or physicians, clinicians might do with human specimens that don't actually meet the definition of human subjects research. Some of these include studying samples from deceased individuals, samples that are taken solely for diagnostic purposes. Specimens are data that are available through catalogs that are commercially available or public repositories or registries and cell lines that are available in the same ways. For example, these things don't meet the definition of human subjects research. So this is just a very general overview of the issues that I want to touch on today. When we're talking about ethical issues in the use of stored samples in research, there are those issues that have to do with the research design. There's a number of decisions that have to be made related to whether scientifically and ethically it makes more sense to collect new samples with prospective consent from subjects, or if there are some efficiencies and other benefits of using existing stored samples. There's also attention that needs to be paid to whether samples will be linked to other kinds of information, like medical records, and whether results that are derived from this research, whether or not they would be disclosed to individuals, potentially to third parties. And then there's a whole separate category of issues related to informed consent. And the concern in general is ensuring that there's adequate disclosure, both for the prospective collection of new samples, as well as looking back on previous consent that was obtained in the context of existing and stored samples to see if those provisions are adequate to cover new research purposes. So let me begin by presenting you with two historical case studies that I think do a nice job of illustrating some of these questions. So the first study, the first case refers to so-called look-back studies, and I'm going to talk about an example that has to do with hepatitis C virus infection. So researchers, including a number here at the NIH, were aware that it would be very useful to be able to conduct research on the long-term health outcomes on for individuals who are otherwise healthy, young individuals who were infected with hepatitis C virus. There's a couple of different scientific approaches that these investigators could have taken. They could, at this time, enroll healthy young individuals with hepatitis C infection and follow them over the course of a number of decades. This kind of research is very expensive, very labor-intensive, but would certainly paint a good picture. Another possibility would be to do a retrospective cohort study using stored samples if the right kinds of samples and associated data existed. And the opportunity to do that did, in fact, arise. They discovered a collection of serum samples, thousands of them, that were collected in the 1940s and 50s from military recruits. At the time, they were collected for the purposes of studying the relationship between group A strep infection and acute rheumatic fever. These samples had been stored in frozen storage in glass, rubber cap vials all of this time and were almost 100% intact and still useful today. And so this is one of the key points is that samples often can be stored indefinitely and used many, many years later than they were collected. The researchers were able to test these samples for the presence of the hepatitis C virus antibodies to determine who had been infected at the time and who wasn't. The samples were also very clearly identified, both with names and military service numbers. So this made it fairly straightforward to link the samples and the data that they had determined to other data, well, to Social Security numbers and medical and demographics that then allowed them to get into medical records in the VA and HICVA to look at how their health had evolved since the time the samples were collected. This turned out to be a very important set of studies for several reasons. They had a particular historical significance because they established that, in fact, there was hepatitis C virus infection in the U.S. prior to the previously reported earliest case results, case finding in 1968. It also established that individuals who were infected were at a lower risk for developing progressive liver disease than was previously thought. So out of all of those samples, 17 were found to have the virus antibodies. Two out of those 17, 12% compared to 2% of the virus negative individuals had gone on to develop liver disease. So far from inevitable, certainly a somewhat higher number than uninfected individuals, but not as high as assumed. So this study raised a number of questions for the IRB that reviewed it. The first set of questions had to do with informed consent. When should subjects be asked, be recontacted to reconsent for the use of their samples prior to new research being done? In this case, it was actually determined that it would be both unnecessary and I imagine also impractical to go back and recontact these individuals. And they had already consented to participate in the prior research. The understanding was that they had actually consented to some kind of research participation. This is also an interesting question to consider in the context of military subjects versus civilian subjects and whether there's any differences there. And I won't go too far into that right now. But there was also a question about whether and when it's appropriate to inform the individuals regarding positive test results. And so this requires a weighing of the potential benefits of informing people who perhaps weren't aware that they were infected, who might even still be infectious, versus the risks to the subject of receiving a cold call from an investigator. Oh, by the way, you might not have known that we were doing this research, but we found out this thing about you that could lead to some distress among the subjects. There's also the potential for additional scientific knowledge to be gained in this case because the scientists were not actually aware of how long the virus stays in the system. And so being able to recontact people and retest for the presence of these antibodies would be valuable. So it was decided on balance to attempt to recontact the 12 individuals. And they found that 10 were still alive. And of those, the researchers actually were successfully able to track down 7 of them, none of whom seemed to be terribly upset to be recontacted, some of whom were unaware that they were infected, and several of whom the presence of the virus was still detected. So case number 2. The breast cancer prevention trial, a slightly larger scale study, established that tamoxifen could significantly reduce the incidence of invasive breast cancer in women who were at high risk with a strong family history. This study was conducted in the early to mid-1990s. It was initiated before the mutations for BRCA1 and 2 were cloned. So it wasn't part of the study designed to test the samples that were obtained from women for these mutations. And so the study was not able to establish who, with one or the other of these kinds of mutations, would benefit more from this kind of treatment. Upon completion of the study, investigators wanted to be able to go back to these DNA samples and test for these mutations. Now, although women had not given explicit consent for these specific mutations to be tested, they did give general consent for future genetic research to be done with their samples. So after some amount of deliberation, the investigators and the IRB decided that they would recontact all the participants in this study. They would send them a letter, tell them what the plans were, and give them an opportunity to opt out, to withdraw their sample from the research and therefore not participate in this research. The notion was that unless they heard from individuals, they would keep the samples in the study, would anonymize them so that they could no longer be linked back to the individuals in the study, and then the research would be conducted with no intentions and, in fact, no possibility of being able to recontact the women. So this is what was done. The investigators had, I think, zero people actually opt out of the study, if I remember correctly, from a conversation with Mary Claire King. Now, I will say that because they had anonymized the samples, this meant that this limited greatly the utility of these samples for future research. They could no longer be linked back to medical records of these individuals. And there are a number of people associated with this research who regretted that decision and wish they hadn't cut off that ability. This was indeed a very conservative approach to this kind of research. And this was largely because of a very strong fear at the time related to what the impact of BRCA testing might be, that it might connect to these concerns about discrimination, largely then and even still hypothetical, but this is what was driving the concerns at this time. I can say that the NHGRI intramural IRB here just in the past few months reviewed a very similar set of studies for a different rare disease, and the investigator wanted permission to use samples that were collected years ago, and this was without explicit consent related to any kind of genetic research, and it was with a desire to keep the samples linked to medical records, and the IRB approved this with a similar opt-out approach, but they approved it without requiring the anonymization of the samples after the fact. So these two examples, I think, do a nice job of highlighting some of the issues, but I want to underscore that in some ways they're very small-scale examples of studies. I couldn't resist an analogy to Bruce Springsteen. Both Ben and I grew up in neighboring towns in New Jersey, so I thank you for indulging me on this. If the conventional research research with stored samples as exemplified by these two cases is analogous to Bruce Springsteen's coffee house days, then biobanking really can be said to be more analogous with the stadium concerts of today, both in terms of magnitude and the technology involved. Biobanks are valuable because of their massive size, and not only are they massive, but they're also much more complicated, and this raises a number of unique issues. Whereas in traditional research, you had one individual or a research team with one set of defined studies, in biobanks, you often have not the person doing the research, but a broker or an intermediary who's archiving and storing the samples. And it's possible that many studies are going to be conducted with those stored samples, with that archive. Future uses in traditional research aren't explicitly anticipated, whereas that's the entire point of biobanks is lots of future uses, some of which can't even be conceived at the time that the biobank is created. There's also a model of one study, one consent in traditional models of research, where there's a need for something closer to a blanket or more general approach to consent with biobanks. So there's many different kinds of biobanking models. This is probably the most simple model and probably even oversimplified. But there's a lot of variations in what exactly is stored, genes, exposures, relationships between genes and data, and also who creates the archive, who funds it, and then ultimately who uses it. And here's a model of a much more complex type of biobank. And there's ethical issues at each layer, at every layer from the points of collection of the samples and data to the way in which that they're stored to their distribution and uses by researchers. There's key ethical issues that come up at every layer. Is human subjects research involved? Is IRB review required? Is informed consent required? Or alternatively, was previous informed consent adequate? How do the privacy rule, the HIPAA privacy rule, state and local regulations, how do these things apply? And in general, what limits are there, both ethically and just responsibly and based on the policies of the individual archives in terms of the kinds of research that can be done? So this complexity has even led to new levels of review. For example, in NIH genome-wide association studies, there's a new layer of review called the DAC, Data Access Committees, which take a look at this specific question of whether the consent that was used previously to collect samples, whether it's adequate to cover the proposed future uses on this side each time a researcher wants to request access to samples from dbGaP or another public repository of these kinds of data. So much is made of this distinction between identifiable samples and data and those that cannot be identified or those that are de-identified. And these two circumstances can lead investigators down two very different paths. The general sense is that when samples are identifiable, you have human subjects research. Researchers have to go through an IRB. Issues of consent come up unless an exemption or a waiver can be applied. You might be out of the woods if the samples are deemed to not be identified, although that may, as mentioned before, give you less utility when it comes to using the samples. This distinction between what is identifiable and what isn't is an area of considerable debate. One set of definitions comes from OHRP, the Office for Human Research Protections, which is the oversight agency for all federally funded research in this country. They have determined as recently as 2004 that samples that are not identifiable have to do with whether or not the identity of the individuals can be readily ascertained. So they don't consider research with they don't consider the activity to be research with human subjects if the private information or specimens were not collected specifically for the proposed research, and the investigator cannot readily ascertain the identity of the individuals. So this could be achieved through a confidentiality agreement between the person who did originally collect the samples and the new researcher who wants to obtain them for his or her new research purposes. I should say that this definition is not necessarily consistent with the definition that the FDA puts forth, with the definition that's included in the HIPAA privacy rule, and there's even inconsistency across different institutions in how this definition gets interpreted and implemented. And one thing I can say, certainly here at the NIH, it's not up to an investigator to make this determination. At the very least, most institutions want to be involved in some way in making the determination about whether the activity involves human subject research. And so, for example, here at the NIH, this would be something that an investigator would submit to the Office for Human Subjects Research, OHSR, a slightly different acronym, to make that determination. It's a very confusing area of policy, and one that there are now individuals who are attempting to harmonize the definitions across the different federal agencies to make it a little bit easier, particularly on IRBs, to figure out exactly how to interpret these regulations. But some people take a step back and remember what they learned in high school biology and ask, wait a second, isn't by definition the human genome uniquely identifiable? Isn't it like snowflakes and fingerprints, and can't we always determine individuals by the makeup of their genome? Well, to some extent, that's actually true, and technology, emerging technology, makes that more and more true. So genome-wide association studies, I've mentioned this a couple of times. This is a very large-scale initiative to explore, to collect samples, to sequence the entire genome associated with those samples, and it allows researchers to explore the connections between specific genes, the genotypic information, and their outward expression or phenotypic information. And they're supposed to be very rapid and cost-effective approaches to determining the links between people with specific diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and so on, compared to healthy individuals. And there's also a lot of emphasis put on making these data widely available to share within the research community, and that being a part of what facilitates the rapid generation of these results. So these studies involve assessing many single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs as they're known, per sample, storing these on databases. And the individual SNP patterns can reveal information that is unique to individuals. In 2004, a group of individuals said that's anywhere between 30 and 80 SNPs were all that it would take to uniquely identify a single person. Now, I should point out that in order to identify a person in this way, you need some kind of a reference sample. You need, here's the sample that I think matches to this person, and you would try to hook them up. And that harkens in many people's minds to a law enforcement context, where you might have a piece of evidence that you want to try to match to information in a database. It's also been said that the individual SNP patterns can reveal, without that reference sample, can reveal some information about the ethnicity of the individual, if not pinning them down to a unique individual. And this poses a risk of group harms, which Ben talked about a bit in his talk. So the absolute latest up-to-date information on identifiability, in August of this year, David Craig's group at TGen published a paper in PLOS Genetics showing that they were able to detect a single person's SNP profile in an aggregated data set of 1,000 of over 1,000 individuals' DNA samples. This was a finding that kind of sent shockwaves through the research community. It had several reverberations, including a change in the GWAS data sharing policy. Because bioinformatics techniques have now advanced to the point where if you have genomic data on a person from another source, you can figure out who they are in pooled summary data sets. They decided to take those kinds of data sets off of public portions of databases so that this information isn't just simply out there for anyone in the public to have access to. Individual investigators can still apply and request access to this information, but it's much more controlled. So, as Ben mentioned in his previous talk, the primary risks of using identifiable samples mainly have to do with risks that are associated with disclosure. These disclosures can be to third parties. They are sometimes characterized as erroneous or mistaken disclosures that can lead to embarrassment, that could have legal or financial ramifications. It can deprive people of certain entitlements and benefits and could lead to stigmatization. This has to do with employment, insurance discrimination, as some people have mentioned. It could have to do with disclosures in a law enforcement context. And not all of these disclosures will necessarily be malicious. They might be quite intentional, or they might be unintentional related to the publication of data that might end up stereotyping a group of individuals. There's a number of ways that this could play out. There's also a risk associated with disclosures to individuals, a privacy intrusion, and anxiety and confusion associated with trying to interpret results. Don't need to spend a lot of time on these because they were already well covered by Ben. I do want to just mention some of the research design measures that are aimed at protecting against these risks in a bit more detail. So the first step is to take efforts to maximize confidentiality protections. So techniques like anonymization and coding and encryption of information on computers are all steps that are commonly talked about. The HIPAA privacy rule and some others have introduced the idea of the least necessary or the least identifiable data set. And this has to do with investigators only collecting and using the minimal amount of information needed to answer their scientific questions and not just kind of keeping everything in a just-in-case kind of mode. People also have talked about the use of an intermediary, and this could take several different forms, but an intermediary who would hold the link, somebody who's unrelated to the research endeavor, but they would hold the link between the code and the identifiers to add an additional layer of protection. And then there's a lot of effort placed on obtaining legal protections in addition to things that might be fairly common sense, like not placing data on computers that are linked to the internet unless this is the explicit intention of the database. This can offer significant protection against hackers accessing data. People talk about certificates of confidentiality as a protection against the obtaining of third parties obtaining the information through subpoena. So this is a very specific context that applies to fears in the context of law enforcement. And then there's also speculation about whether GINA, whether the provisions of federal comprehensive legislation to protect against discrimination in two very narrow and specific contexts, employment and health insurance, whether that will offer real protections or at least alleviate people's fears of discrimination in those contexts in a way that benefits research. And then Ben also fleshed out very nicely that there's the need to pay a lot of attention to the approaches for recontacting subjects, particularly when the intention is to provide them with results. And there has to be a good reason for doing that and very careful and adequate disclosure associated with doing this. So, turning to informed consent, questions of if and when consent is needed, and then also how best to get consent when it's determined that it is in fact needed. So the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, which wrote a fairly influential report on this subject in 1999, they recommended that research that's conducted with unidentifiable samples is not human subjects research and is not regulated by the common rule, whereas research using coded or identifiable samples requires the consent of the source unless the criteria for a consent waiver have been satisfied. And so just to review quickly, the criteria for a waiver of informed consent are that the protocol must involve minimal risk, and some people think that in genetic research and in research with stored tissues, the risk determination hinges on whether or not there's an intention to provide results back to subjects or not. And if there is that intent, this increases the risk and that it's at least more likely that we should get informed consent from individuals. And then there's language about not adversely affecting the rights and welfare of the subjects and some sense of impracticability of obtaining consent. So here's that same diagram again. And there is considerable debate about whether one can obtain valid consent for future research with stored samples when those future purposes have not yet been anticipated. So if it's not possible to talk about the specific disease, genes, methodologies, time frame, and even who will have access to the samples. Some think that it's still possible to get sufficient informed consent under those circumstances, like the College of American Pathologists, who recommend this kind of language for consent forms. I consent to the donation of my tissues for research and education, period. If you wish to decline donation, indicate with your initials here. So this is published as one possible approach to informed consent. In stark contrast, we have the National Bioethics Advisory Commission report, which recommends options and lots of additional information, such as how identifiability will be protected or not, whether the research is going to involve just this one study with or without future contact, future studies with or without future contact, or just open-ended use. So I've mentioned that there are significant debates over a number of issues related to this kind of research, and this is where at least social scientists like myself like to think that there may be a role for empirical data on public attitudes about informed consent and about this kind of research. And so I and my colleagues have been involved in some different kinds of research to try to drive down and get a little bit closer to understanding how we might make some of these decisions. I'm not going to report the data here in detail, but we've looked at variability across consent forms, just in terms of how genetic research and research with stored samples is being described. And even at a single research institution like the NIH, across the, at the time, 14 different intramural IRBs, there was just considerable variability, ranging in as much detail from what you saw in the CAP recommended statement to the NBAC style. And I can also say that the NHGRI IRB has adopted an approach somewhere in the middle between those two styles of consent forms. I've also spent some time looking at subject attitudes and their informational needs around informed consent for this kind of research. For example, in one of our surveys, we asked patients at academic medical centers how important they think it is to know about genetic research being done with the tissue samples that were originally collected in a clinical context. And you can see here that although we as policymakers and ethicists might make a lot of the distinction between anonymous and identifiable samples, you can see that patients don't. A substantial majority wanted to know about research being done with their samples, whether it was being done in a way that was anonymous or identifiable. And they were divided in terms of whether knowing about the research required full informed consent and written permission or some other kind of notification. Now, if they were asked to give their permission, we see a fairly high willingness to participate. Over 80% of our sample would be willing to give their blood to a genetic researcher if asked. They just want to be asked. In terms of the scope, how far their informed consent goes, you can see that almost 80% said it would be okay with them if their sample was used to study different diseases over time, different than the one that they originally had consented to. Nearly three-quarters would be willing to sign a one-time release that's in contrast to being recontacted and reconsented for every subsequent study. And a slightly lower majority even said it would be okay for different researchers to use their sample if those researchers were studying the same original disease that they had consented to. These are some data that we are currently writing up. And we can also see that at least some of the attitudinal data that we collected bears out in practice. So coming back to the NHANES study that I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, the upshot of that whole discussion, the task force, and the deliberations around the question of what to do with these existing samples, the group decided that what they needed to do was actually to collect new samples with new consent, because it was just so far removed than the original intentions of the study, and they wanted to make sure that they covered a broad range of issues in the new consent form. So they approached people in 1999 and again in 2000, asked for willingness to do this, and found that between 84 and 85% of the people that they approached did in fact consent to have a fresh sample collected for the express purpose of a DNA sample being used in genetic analyses. In these 2 years, females and black participants were slightly less likely to consent, still a majority, but a statistically significant lower number of people, depending on the year, said that they were willing to do this. So a couple of unresolved issues, questions about the acceptability of blanket consent. Well, we know that at least some subjects might be willing to give a broader one-time consent, but this has to be explored in more detail. Questions about the provision of results, balancing individual rights and interests with potential harms from invalidated results, questions around the enrollment of minors in studies of this sort, and one issue we haven't talked much about, but questions come up in the area of ownership and commercialization of samples and the products derived from research with samples, and people are looking into whether models of profit and benefit sharing might be useful to incorporate into biobanking, and also the notion of custodianship. And one of these really sticky issues has to do with evolving definitions of identifiable, and to the extent that human protection regulations only kick in when you have something that's identifiable, this part of the moving target equation is a real challenge for IRBs and for others to figure out what to do with on a day-to-day basis. So it may be that the model, the research ethics paradigm that you've talked about in this course and the associated practices and regulations that have evolved over the last few decades, that they're really not suited, they're not well tailored to the ever-increasing use of biobanks, genomic databases, and that they don't fit these complex models. When I was just recently at the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities meeting in Cleveland, I heard a very compelling talk from Kelly Fire Edwards, who's one of Ben's colleagues out in Seattle, and she's developing a set of arguments around the model of stewardship and whether that would be a more applicable model to biobanking. She's noticed that biobanking involves the sharing of samples and data beyond the original relationship between an individual and an investigator that was originally established. And so there's issues of trust and control at play here, and where traditional research ethics has relied very heavily on notions of informed consent and on the individual, it may be that a broad and are more contract-based that we need. Biobanking needs to take into account models of families and communities, unknown future uses, diverse motivations, and other contexts that look much more broadly to the common good and call for some additional protections, possibly some new levels of review, not necessarily in the model of the DAC, the data, data access committees that look at the adequacy of informed consent, but something much broader that's looking at the overall process and taking all of these issues into account. So I leave you with that thought, and I welcome your questions.
I just wanted to ask, do you see anything different with collecting MRI scans or that type of data information?
Actually, that does raise many of the same sorts of issues, both in terms of the uncertain clinical significance sometimes of those data, the questions about whether and how to disclose that, whether and how to follow up with adequate interpretation and counseling, and it could raise some of the very same issues and could cause some of the same anxieties and harms. And it's an issue that's currently under discussion even here at the NIH as to how best to handle. So I would very much categorize it. It doesn't raise necessarily questions of genetics and genomics at all, but many of the same issues in terms of risks to individuals and implications.
Ben? Sarah, I wanted to go back to earlier in your talk when you're describing the recent decision to make the publicly available databases more restricted.
Mm-hmm.
As I understood it, the reasoning was, if you had, let's say I was in a study, you know, and I was in the database, what it would require is that I have a sample from me, and then I happen to know somebody really, really smart who is really good at bioinformatics, and he can then say, yeah, I can find you in there. I want to make sure I get that right. That's essentially what the issue is.
Yeah.
That strikes me as being a really small issue. Because you have to have the sample, you have to have the really smart person, you already are together. And so I'm not quite sure I fully appreciate how this would play out in a real-world scenario that would actually cause people to be concerned.
Yeah. Well, I can say a couple things about that. At present, and to my knowledge, these concerns are purely hypothetical in the research context. I have not been able to find a single case example of harm.
If those who are outside could come on in so we could start, we'll get on with the case discussion. Not yet. Can you hear me? Oh, good. Okay. So we're going to have time for a case discussion similar to what we did a few weeks ago, a sort of mock IRB kind of discussion, but a different case. So I'm going to start again with just a few slides to remind you what the case is about, and then we'll discuss it. So this is a proposal to do genetic research in the Aka Pygmy people in the Central African Republic. So background, CCCH tandem zinc fingers are critical to the stability of some messenger RNA. Four proteins have been isolated in this family, including the ones on this slide, TTP 11B, 11D, and one that's found in some animals. TTP is the best studied, and it has been shown critical to destabilizing the messenger RNA of certain GMCSF and TNF-alpha. The deficiency of this protein is linked to systemic inflammatory diseases. So in the Environmental Genome Project, the researchers are studying the stability of certain types of messenger RNA, and they examine DNA from samples that were kept in the Coriel repository. And they selected randomly 72 samples equally divided between people who were of Caucasian ancestry, Asian ancestry, and African ancestry. Of the 72 genomes, one had a null mutation for one of these, for one allele of the gene for one of these zinc proteins, 11B. And this is one of the zinc finger proteins of interest in their research. This particular genome that had the null mutation came from a female Aka pygmy from the Central African Republic. The investigators say, we presume but cannot prove that these other members of the CCCH tandem zinc finger family will play a role in the turnover of some messenger RNA species, and that both the homozygous and the putative homozygous states might be associated with clinical disease. So they're interested in finding more of these mutations and then looking to see their relationship with diseases, predictably inflammatory, but not necessarily. So they propose that in order to obtain a larger number of DNA samples that might have this null mutation, they want to go back to the Aka pygmies in the Central African Republic and collect about 1,000
samples from people in this population to look at the frequency of the 11B mutation in the population. They're also interested in the phenotypic expression of such a mutation in terms of human disease, but as you might have read, the degree to which they're going to look at it at this point is fairly limited. They suggest that this might lead to the knowledge of the function of these zinc proteins and insights into how they're related to or how they might cause human diseases. They propose to work with an American anthropologist who has conducted research in this population with the Akapignes in the CAR for about 20 years. Their proposal is that they will contact individuals and families for participation in the research on the road, because this is a nomadic group. They don't have a particular place where they live. They're nomadic. They propose to use an oral process of consent, explain the study to them, ask them for samples, and not have anything written. The study procedures will involve using a toothbrush. They'll give each individual who agrees to participate a toothbrush, ask them to scrape the buccal membranes or swab the buccal membranes and spit into a cup. Then the substances in the cup will be treated with alcohol to preserve the DNA, and the DNA will then be shipped to the United States. The toothbrush will be washed on site with distilled water and given to the person who gave the specimen. The whole procedure should take about 30 seconds. Again, they estimate obtaining, or they would like to obtain, samples from about 1,000 people. They will be both children and adults. The samples will be labeled with the person's name, the location, and the age, so that if, in fact, they find a reasonable frequency of this mutation and they want to come back and look at more phenotypic associations, they will be able to find the people from whom the samples were obtained. I mentioned they're going to transport all the samples to the United States. And in the U.S., the DNA will be extracted from the cells and tested for these mutations and polymorphisms in the 11B genes. Prior to proposing this study, they have had multiple discussions with people on the ground in the Central African Republic. So they've met with the ministers of health and scientific research in the CAR. They've met with the mayor of Bagundu, which is the major city. They've had town meetings in the same city. They've spread the word among acquaintances. They have spoken to individual family groups on the trails in the forest. And as already mentioned, they are proposing to obtain oral consent from individuals when they actually begin the study, and the individuals they meet will be asked orally for consent. They argue that the buccal brushing is a harmless procedure. It's really just is essentially just taking the toothbrush and getting a few DNA skin cells off the inside of the mucous membrane. Each participant will get a new toothbrush, and the researchers will also provide funds to complete the floor of a school that the community has been wanting to complete and will pay for a teacher for 1 year. There will be no physical examination or treatment of other diseases that might appear in these individuals. There won't be any really way of finding if they have other diseases. But they plan to have a more intensive clinical interaction with the community if they do return with a proposal to link some of the mutations with phenotypes and clinical disease. You are the IRB that's asked to review this study and decide whether or not you can approve it. So what issues would you like to consider? Now, I did not give you the entire protocol. So, I mean, this is, again, a real study. I didn't give you the entire protocol because it's like the other one. It's about 60 pages long. So I gave you a short version. So there are some things that you don't know about the study, and I probably don't remember. So I'll make them up if it becomes important. Yeah.
Of the different criteria, I think social value, scientific validity, fairness of subject selection, and independent review are all fine. I have some difficulty with risk-benefit, but not much. And I have main concerns about informed consent and the respect for the participants. The risks are scant, but there's no benefit to these individuals. There might be some future benefit to their community. Their informed consent, I don't think they, no matter what they're told, by whom and in what form, they have the capacity to understand any substantive information. On the other hand, the risks are small. There could be an element in the informed consent of undue influence by offering to build a school, which is tangibly helpful to their community because they have no capacity to understand the other scientific information. In the respect for participants, I think that generally the proposal has their welfare at the top of the list, but how genetic information would be handled and what information would be of cultural or social negative impact on their community, these kinds of issues, I think, which the previous speakers of the day brought out, are concerning. If I had to say yes or no, I'd say yes, go ahead and do it the way you planned it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. So, well, you've done two things for us. One is you put us on the on our trajectory of things that we're supposed to talk about. But you've proposed that social value, scientific validity, fair subject selection, and independent review are fine, is what the first thing you said. And then the second thing you said, that risks are minimal, but there's no benefit to the individuals. You're worried about the fact that they may not be able to give consent, and you're worried about possible undue influence of the school. So who would like to speak to any of those issues? Do you agree with the assessment that the social value, scientific validity, fair subject selection are fine? Do you agree with the questions about risk and benefit or informed consent? Do you have other concerns?
This is best a side issue, but I have a little worry about scientific validity. Why should just finding one mutation in one person give us reason to think that you could find this mutation in a group of 1,000? It seems a bit of a shot in the dark. But, I mean, I don't know anything about this, so perhaps that's not something that is too worrisome. And as to everything else, I think that the study is so low risk that I'm not too worried about any of the other things. I think most conditions are reasonably met. I think the only thing I would demand is that the building of the school should be done. So even if every single pygmy they contact refuses to participate in the study, I think the school should be built anyway.
Okay.
So the kind of undue influence aspect is taken away.
Okay. Nathan.
With regard to social value, I mean, if the issue of responsiveness is an important consideration, as I believe the CIOMS guidelines would suggest, that this really neither addresses a healthcare priority or a healthcare need.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, I mean, I think that's a social value issue, that's really my. Other than that, I think that, you know, this being a very, very low risk study.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because as you heard a week or so ago, there is this requirement for responsiveness when you're going to a resource poor country. There's some debate about it. You heard the debate. But the one way to think about it is that you have to be responsive to either a healthcare priority or a healthcare need. Now, I'm going to be the investigator for a second and argue that, well, there could be a health need here. It's just that we don't know yet the association between this particular genetic mutation and disease. And it could be that in this population there is a lot of disease that's related to this mutation. Then that's something that we're going to look for. It does get also a little bit to the question of, you know, why are we looking in this population of 1,000 when we've only found one? Now, I guess you could argue, well, maybe you should look in some other populations, too, to see if there are similar mutations. But the fact that there was one mutation in this 11B gene that, and the person from whom the gene was collected is alive and functioning, presumably, makes a very interesting case for further analysis of whether or not people are walking around with hemizygous mutations that allow phenotypically normal health situations. So, I mean, I'm not doing a very good job, but I could make a case for scientifically and socially why this is a very important question to ask and may, in fact, be helpful to this population if, in fact, there is a frequency of this mutation. So the question for you guys is that good enough? Is that good enough? Are you going to say, okay, the risk is low, I guess?
In terms of scientific validity, I'd like to know what background information we have about the acopygmies. What do we know about the healthcare problems? Are there healthcare problems that appear to be endemic to this group that are different to the rest of the surrounding population to indicate that there may be some...
So you mean general epidemiological information about what diseases that they have,
yeah,
what their main health
is it different from the other racial groups in the area? Because what's being suggested is that there may be a disease associated with race or with genetics.
Well, let's imagine just for a second that the data that's available suggests that this group, like many others in that country and other countries in the region, their major issues are infectious diseases. But certainly that's not the only health problem they have. There are people that have other more chronic types of diseases. So, I mean, that's the data we have. Infectious disease is their primary health problem, but there are many other across the spectrum of diseases that we see anywhere. Does that help you?
Well, it does somewhat, because if it's suggested that this genetic mutation may impact on their immunological competence and the ability to deal with infections, and again, I'd want some further data to see, well, if these are the major problems, is there a difference in those problems between the morbidity and mortality associated with infections as compared to the other surrounding...
And we could argue that the answer to that question will make much more sense if we understand the genetic mutation, the frequency of this genetic mutation to begin with, because we'll be able to put pieces together about... You know, if there are differences in how people respond to infectious diseases, we might be able to look further as to whether or not the frequency of this mutation is something that's associated with that difference. And so, you know, where do you start is the question. Please.
Even though this protocol itself seems fairly benign in that it's very low risk, I don't think you can really look at it without also looking at if they do find this abnormality, the researchers are going to be back, and I think that protocol could be very problematic in terms of, you know, do they inform the people that are carrying the mutation that they have a mutation? And, you know, given the educational level, how will that be interpreted by the group, and will the people who carry the mutation be ostracized by their peers because the scientists have come in and told them they have something bad in their blood? And I think this really can't be looked at in itself, because if you're just going to find that there's a frequency of the mutation but not go any further than that, then there really is no social value to the program, to the protocol, or scientific validity at all, because that's kind of a meaningless piece of information without knowing how the genotype affects the actual clinical characteristics.
Okay, so great. So in light of that, and in light of the talks that we had already this morning, what do you think ought to be done? I mean, the proposal is to put names and ages and locations on the samples that we're collecting. But I didn't present to you, and I don't think they presented in the protocol. What are they going to do if they find a mutation? How are they going to go back to the individuals for whom they have a sample and now a name and an age? Now, it is possible that they won't be able to find the individual. I mean, I think that's a very high likelihood of that. But let's imagine they can. So, should they, at this point, before they even go looking for the frequency of the genetic mutation, should they make plans with respect to how they're going to recontact people, what they're going to say, what kinds of services they're going to provide, what the meaning of this kind of information would be in that context, the kinds of things that you just said? That may be something that we as an IRB want them to think about now before they do the next study. Other ideas? What about the statement that was made about informed consent? These people can't give informed consent. That was said earlier.
I'm worried about how they're going to get 1,000 people. That's my first question is, are they going to be able to recruit this many, 1,000 pygmies?
Let's imagine that there's, you know, tens of thousands on this forest trails and that 1,000 is a realistic number. Is that a problem in some way?
I still think they're going to be ostracized if they have that genome or that allele.
Okay, so that gets back to the previous comment about, you know, what happens if the mutation is found. Let's imagine at the first step, though, you know, the only thing that would set them apart from somebody who said no to the study is that now they have a toothbrush and maybe the next guy doesn't. Is that, I mean, I'm not trying to be funny. I think that's a question. Is that something that we should worry about? Or it doesn't have to be you, anybody?
Yeah.
No? Okay, so we've had a couple of comments about social value and scientific validity and responsiveness. Yes?
It seems to me that a lot of resources are going to go into, one, tracking down the people and collecting your sample size, and then obviously going through the consent process, doing the testing, but then the shipment of the samples here to the United States is an incredible effort to get it here so that the samples aren't in any way contaminated by the time that they arrive here, for a kind of a shot in the dark where, you know, we saw one in 72, and if you're looking at 1,000 people, if that ratio stays the same, you're talking about maybe 13% of those people even having the mutation. So it just seems like a lot of resources, you know, in time, effort, and finance is going into something that is kind of a shot in the dark and might not have a lot of social value or scientific validity, when a lot of other things are going on or potentially going on that provide more of a social value to that particular region.
Okay, so before you sit down, what would you do as a member of the IRB? Would you say, you shouldn't do this study because it's kind of a shot in the dark? Or, I mean, what, and I might come back to you as an investigator and say, well, it is a little bit of a shot in the dark, but we have reason to believe that there might be this mutation out there and it would be so valuable to our research. Down the road, we'll be able to understand how it's related to health. At this point, we just want to know if it's out there. If people are living human beings who are not sick or who are not sick enough that they can still walk around, have this mutation.
It just seems that maybe more background information about, again, the individuals or the community at large needs to be gathered before, you know, really expending those resources into doing that. From what we saw and read, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of background information that, you know, maybe perhaps could be first looked at before going through all of this.
Okay. So background information about the people, sort of along the lines of what Nathan was saying, that's the kind of background information you want, not the scientific things about zinc proteins.
Yeah.
More about the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to raise a question. I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I want to raise a question about your comment. One of, I think, a controversial issue is whether or not IRBs should care about resources, and whether or not it's in their purview to care about resources. And the question is, you know, some people will argue, your job as an IRB is to care about risks or harm or exploitation of research participants. And somebody else deals with whether it's worth expending the resources on this study. So I don't really want to discuss that any further, but I want to put that out there because some IRBs will not deal with the issue of resources, and there are others that do get into that. Yes?
I guess my question is a good example of how the investigator has to be prepared for any sort of comment from an IRB member.
Right.
And I don't know much about genetic testing, but I know about toothbrushing, and it struck me that infectious diseases are prevalent in this population. I don't know anything about this population. Do they know how to use a toothbrush? Is this toothbrush going to be shared among family members? Does that present any risk? So I'd really like to hear that addressed before I cast my vote.
Are you an infectious disease guy?
I'm with the Office of AIDS Research.
Okay. Well, it's a great question, and in fact, we've shared this particular study with others around the world, and we've done some of these discussions, and this issue comes up all the time, especially from people outside of the U.S. They worry, wait a minute. And it gets to the point of what do we know about the population. As you said, introducing a toothbrush sounds like a harmless thing, maybe a nice thing for somebody to give them a toothbrush that they if they didn't have one. But introducing a toothbrush without worrying about how the toothbrush is going to be used, whether it's going to be shared, how much infectious disease might be transmitted, is actually an important risk that we cannot not take into account. And so giving somebody a toothbrush may be more of a negative than it is a positive. And we need to know more about what the population currently uses, if they do at all, for oral hygiene, and whether or not they understand what a toothbrush is, et cetera, all the things you said, because of the risk of infectious disease. Yeah.
Hey, I'd like to go back to informed consent, and I guess a comment you made earlier there was in reference to the first comment that was made about whether or not the complexity of genetic issues kind of is going to be a problem for getting informed consent. And I guess my first reaction, was that even though I guess the assumption was that a lot of these patients would be relatively uneducated, not know very much about genetics, I might be confused by that sort of thing. And I guess, well, on the one hand, that does seem kind of concerned because the risks of this do seem entirely contingent on, you know, what genetic right. testing entails. I guess then my concern would be who's doing, it's verbal informed consent, and it's the American anthropologist who's doing this informed consent. And we don't see here because
helping.
It's a limited
who's
form.
Who's helping with it?
Right. So, sorry, we don't see here the actual, like, I don't know, script that he's using,
right.
nor do we really know a lot of the details about, you know, the idioms or the right. you know, level of education. So I guess I would personally like to see exactly, you know, the level A the American anthropologist knows about this particular study. Is he one of the investigators or?
He's a collaborator.
He's a collaborator, right. So yeah, and then B, what is he going to be, you know, saying exactly to these people and how can you expect the level of comprehension to be of these issues? Etc. I would have liked to see a more detailed discussion.
Okay, so that's fair. You as the IRB may need to see the script, what people are going to be told, and to take into account, I think, some of the things that you raised over here. You know, how much in this society does genetics constitute the risk of stigma or discrimination? The things that we worried about in the last two talks, you know, these are the things that people worry about. Disclosing results because there is stigma and discrimination or the possibility of that plus psychological reaction. So the question is, in this society, is that the same thing? I mean, will there be discrimination? Will there be stigma? Maybe there won't. I mean, maybe genetics is such a new entity that there won't be anything associated, it won't be any reaction associated with it. I think that's a possibility. But we need to be very careful to think through not only what we're going to tell people, but to understand that somebody, whether it's the anthropologist or somebody else, who knows the culture, can be confident that what we're planning to tell people is appropriate for that context in terms of what they should worry about. Yeah.
I'm going to apologize before I do this, but I haven't heard one comment so far that sounded like you were thinking like pygmies living in the Central African Republic. But actually, IRBs are intended to be a local, to put things in the context of the local setting where the trial is going to be done and to ask whether this is ethical and appropriate. So I'll try doing it in reverse. There are a group of Central African pygmy scientists who have discovered a gene that is only present in one person in the clinical center, and they would like to do a study in the clinical center of having them brush their oral mucosa, and then send samples to the Central African Republic. This gene puts people at special risk of sudden death before the age of 50. It's thought to be fairly rare, but still they want to know more information. They're willing to share it if they find it. If you look at it that way, and you think, oh, my God, what are they doing? That may be the way this study is seen in the Central African Republic. I say that because I keep hearing people say, well, it's not that much of a risk. But I didn't get how this was really going to help any of the pygmies. I didn't get that they went and looked at what do the pygmies need the most and is this something we really ought to work on and, okay, we're going to do a study, which is, I think, number one in the list.
Okay, great. Great way to sort of put it into perspective. So, number one on the list is this sort of nebulous idea of collaborative partnership. Now, I'm going to defend the study for a second. You know, I've spoken to the Minister of Health.
and the Minister of Science and Technology. I've met with the mayor. I've met with groups of people on the road. I've met with families. Everybody's okay with this. They're happy to do the study. They want, you know, they want attention to their community, and they want the school. So, you know, and they don't see any risk of the, you know, buccal swabs. Now, you've raised, and somebody else raised earlier, the issue of, okay, the risks are pretty small, but there's no benefits to these individuals. So the question is, you know, when is it okay to do a study when there's no benefit to the individuals in the, no possible benefit to the individuals in the study? In this case, if we came back later on, if we had plans to come back and try to, you know, match up phenotype with genotype, one could argue maybe there's benefit at that point in time. But at this point, no, there's no benefit. I'm just trying to find out how many people have this mutation. But is that okay? The risks are really, really low. Or are they? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent way of looking at the issue. I wouldn't have any problems with pygmies coming here and doing research on us, especially not if they gave us a university or hospital or something like that. I think the only thing we would have to be worried about was the way they treat the genetic information, and perhaps if it was a country where we thought it was going to be a totalitarian regime, but I think those risks even would be fairly low. So, because there's going to be the school, I don't have an issue with it, but I think it's a really, really good way of looking at it. And yeah. I'm just going to run through a few other things. So one thing I was worried about with the toothbrush is, what if they come across a family group? I don't know anything about these people, but let's say they move around in family groups. And presumably, as a scientist, you don't want to sample, you know, the 10 siblings or something, because they will all have very similar, you know, you want to sample different people. So what are you going to do with fair subject selection and who gets a toothbrush? So that was one worry. I'm less worried than I was in a previous study about all sorts of cultural issues, because there's been this consultation with all the local people and the local communities, and there's going to be an anthropologist who presumably knows this community better than any other Western individual, although there might be some power worries there. But what I did want to ask for the first speaker, who highlighted the fact that there might be an issue with informed consent because pygmies might not understand the process or the procedure or the information, I'd wonder if you could clarify what he meant. And final point, as for the follow-up study, I wouldn't want the researchers to say now what they're going to do next, but I would require them to come through the IRB review completely with a new study, and I would like them to know that it may well be the case that their next study will not be approved.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That there's no entailment from this study to the next study. And if they're going to say, well, but now we wasted all these resources on the first study, too bad, that was your gamble.
Now, in that regard, would you have anything to say about whether or not they should label the samples that they're collecting? I mean, you say it may or may not allow a second study depending on how it's put together. I mean, one recommendation was to, you know, have more about the second study now so we could decide whether it's worth labeling the samples.
I didn't have such an issue with labeling the samples. Presumably they're just gonna test these samples for this one mutation.
Yes.
And I don't have such an issue with them labeling it. I mean, I assume there's certain things in place, right? That the anthropologist who knows the people doesn't get to know the mutation result and stuff like that. In that case, I don't have such an issue with the labeling.
Okay.
But it may well be that if the study comes back for IRB review, that I would say, well, actually, I don't think you should go back and contact these people. I think you're going to have to go out there again, find 1,000 people again, swipe them,
start all over,
get their medical information at the same time, or something like that.
Okay. And why not do that now? Resources?
I'm kind of leaving this up to the researchers. I mean, they clearly want to just do it step-by-step basis. I'm happy to go along with that. I mean, Presumably they've thought about why they just want to think about this. I mean, they clearly acknowledge that it's a shot in the dark. I mean, probably they think the chances aren't actually that large that they have to go back in there, so why raise all these? Besides, they will probably gain a lot of knowledge about a population and about how to sampling, which you could use in your next IRB review, which you currently don't have.
Okay. So did you... Dr. Hughes, did you want to respond to the question about why you think informed consent is impossible in this setting?
The four elements are disclosure, capacity, something which I forget, and authorization. And if for no other reason, capacity here is non-existent. They simply will never comprehend with any amount of information the genetic background to appreciate the need or relevance of this study.
They're
I didn't hear all the question.
The question was, why do you think they don't have the capacity to comprehend? Is that by virtue of them being Africans, virtue of being poor?
Well,
what is the reason that you assume that they can't?
Well, I have trouble understanding the zinc something or other gene hemizygous allelic relevance with the phenotypic expression and so forth and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure geneticists and people in this field would understand it. I can appreciate the social value and the scientific validity, which I commented on. But despite my background in medicine, I don't understand all the details. And I don't think that the individuals, the population here, will be able to appreciate with sufficient capacity the relevance and potential importance of the study in order to give informed consent by our current definition.
I have a comment, but if that's the case, if we need to understand these issues at the level of in which a scientist understands them, then it turns out that we will only be able to do research using scientists as human subjects, right? And that's not the case here.
So. You learn what DNA is. More
or less. I'm not that sure.
And I think you've heard that most people have heard the term, and it's something that's mentioned in school.
But if you do a study like that, say on children or people non-educated, you bother to present. I mean, the informed consent form is presented in such a way that people with no education can understand it. So I think that we should not pretty much assume that. That people in other parts of the world, because they haven't been exposed to certain information, cannot understand at all. I think the burden is on the side of the researcher who has to explain things in a way that makes some sense and people can understand them. And I don't think that that's impossible.
I don't disagree with you, but that's why I think an IRB waiver of informed consent, which earlier today we heard might apply to a tissue specimen, might in this case apply to an entire being, because if you don't think they have the capacity to understand and give informed consent, then you might as well move on to the next issue. And that's why at the end I said I would still approve this study if I had to shoot from the hip.
So I'm going to...
You're carrying the logic to extremes, which I didn't mean to imply. We've had many examples of differences of opinion, even among the ethicists here during this course, and so it's not unusual that this controversial issue has taken different opinions and points of view.
Okay, I'm going to just say one thing about that, and then let's have the last comment. It is true, however, that as an IRB, you have to come to some resolution about this issue. So you either have to waive the consent process, you either have to agree that the script that you're going to be presented is adequate, you have to build in a way to assess capacity, or you have to assume that what you're presenting to people will be understood. So you have to make that decision at some level. Please.
I want to go back to some of the things you were saying about the collaborative partnership and that you've
Great.
Talked to the Ministry of Health, you've talked to the mayor. I mean... The script that we got seemed to make it sound like this tribe was pretty primitive.
Yes.
And do they recognize the Minister of Health or the mayor as someone who has any jurisdiction over them whatsoever? They might not. I mean, they might
yeah.
be their own tribal entity and their own tribal government, and they could care less what the Minister of Health in the big city thought.
Right. That's a great question.
And so that's not really a collaborative partnership. And then my other question or point I want to make is, if they're nomadic, what good is a school?
Mm. Well, those are both very good questions that I'm not going to try to answer. But I think it does raise, again, the important issue that if you are an IRB that's reviewing a study like this and you're sitting here in Bethesda, you need somebody who understands the situation on the ground to be able to help you answer those questions. And then you have to decide whether or not the person is credible and whether or not the answers satisfy you enough to be able to say, go ahead. Now, certainly, the more we require investigators to do something called collaborative partnership, we're going to have this issue. Well, I spoke to the Minister of Health, and I spoke to the collaborators on the ground, and the question that an IRB might reasonably ask is, what does that mean in terms of understanding the community or the community understanding the science? I think that's a very good point. So you want to raise hands? Who wants to vote for the protocol as is? Approve it. Nobody. A couple people. Okay, so asking for a script, maybe making some plans for the second step, either not, you know, making sure that that's clear, maybe gathering some more information from the about the community. Anybody want to vote for it with those stipulations?
No toothbrush?
Do you want to get rid of the toothbrush?
Yes.
Get rid of it. Okay. Give them a penny. All right. We could talk about this some more, but I want to give you time to do your post-tests and your evaluations. I appreciate so much the fact that you all came. I hope you've enjoyed this class. I hope it's given you things to think about, ways to challenge things that you've already been presented with in your respective works. Please write on the evaluation things you think we can do better. We will try to do them better next time around. And thank you very much for coming.